Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The good news is he appears to be doing better. He's never had any cognitive impairment, to my knowledge. And as long as he is capable of doing the job, I'm going to continue to support him.
If Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell steps down, who could lead?
I would say that there's not a race for leader underway because there's no vacancy. But I'll just point out the fact that I have been in the Senate for 20 years now, been in leadership, various leadership roles. I feel like I've learned quite a bit about how this place operates, most of which I learned from Mitch McConnell, who's literally a master of the Senate.
Texas Senator John Cornyn.
But I've made no secret of the fact that when the time comes, I'd be interested in being considered by my colleagues. I don't know when that's going to be. I know it's not now.
This is Agriculture Today.
Either a continuing resolution or an omnibus bill.
Texas Senator John Cornyn referring to the potential of a government shutdown.
This is not the way the Senate is supposed to work. So it's no surprise Senator Schumer created this problem and then decided to criticize the House of Representatives for their failure to do what he wanted them to do when it comes to the appropriations bill. This is a textbook Schumer, and unfortunately, it's all too predictable. Unfortunately, when this happens, it means roughly that 98 other senators basically have very little input into the final product, and that you're left with the only a vote yes or no.
He says at the heart of the issue are House Republicans wanting to get a handle on debt.
It's no secret that the national debt has ballooned to now $32 trillion. And I think the House of Representatives is doing what the voters wanted them to do in trying to rein in spending even more than the spending cap in the debt ceiling agreement. That's entirely their prerogative since the Congress appropriates the money. But rather than rolling up the sleeves and working with the House and the other members of the Senate, Senator Schumer's accusing the Republicans in the House who were debating spending cuts, accusing them of playing political games. But it's ultimately the game that he has played that that is causing this pileup and all of the drumbeat of shutdowns when nobody that I know of wants a shutdown except perhaps Senator Schumer. And then he could blame that on Republicans.
So does this mean a shutdown is inevitable?
My prediction is there will be no shutdown. I do think, unfortunately, since there's inadequate time to do the normal appropriations process, that there will be a continuing resolution where we will have no alternative but to kick the can down the road and to revisit all of this subject later on in the fall. It didn't have to be this way, but when you delay until the last few days before the end of the fiscal year, this is what you get.
Because all of this debate simply cuts into the opportunity to debate the farm bill.
Well, as you know, the farm bill is usually a marriage of two things. One is support for our agriculture communities, which provide one out of every seven jobs, I think, in the state of Texas. It's very important to our economy, and obviously we all like to eat. So the food and fiber they produce is critical. But about 80% of it, I think, is food programs, SNAP, WIC, and the like. And those are some of the areas that that are very challenging because, as you know, the size of the farm bill is growing to historic heights. And again, the more the federal government pours gas on the inflation fire, the worse it gets. So this is still a work in progress. Obviously, there are parts of this that are being debated that are controversial, things like work requirements and the like. But it's pretty clear that we will blow through the September 30 deadline, and there'll have to be some sort of extension.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
How we deliver that product into the animal, and that is actually regulated by FDA.
Texas A&M beef cattle specialist Ron Gill on antibiotics in beef cattle.
There's routes of administration that we have to adhere to. We also have to adhere to placement of the product. Some antibiotics are only labeled to be put in specific areas of an animal. Nearly all of them are going subcutaneous. There are some actually that have to be placed behind the ear because that's the only place that is approved by FDA. So once again, how we deliver that product into the animal is important because that affects how long it stays in the system, and that is a result of how long it actually took to get into the system and be effective. So how long we treat an animal is also specified on the label. And so if we can only treat it for 3 days with that product, that's what we have to adhere to. Now, a veterinarian can come in and change some of that and do what we call extra label prescription of these products, where we can go a longer length of time, a higher dose rate. But if we do any of that as a producer, we have to do so under the direction of a veterinarian and the instruction of a veterinarian. In part because that leads to the next part, how long do we have to withhold that animal from market to allow the antibiotics to clear their system? So that's one of the misconceptions out there about how long antibiotics are in there or how much antibiotics are in meat. The FDA has established withdrawal periods for every antibiotic, and that is the best estimate of how long it will take the animal to metabolize that compound in their system and excrete it as the metabolites. And so that's important to remember. We need to adhere to a minimum of that established withdrawal time. Some antibiotics will be completely eliminated from the system within that withdrawal period, and some of them just get below what we call a tolerance level. And that's a level that the FDA has deemed safe for human consumption. It may not be that everything is eliminated from the system. So that's where we as producers have to realize that even though we clear withdrawal times, there could still be a small amount of antibiotic left in the animal. And that's where extended withdrawal periods are the need for some people not to consume animals that have ever been treated with antibiotics. So we have to keep that in mind, as that's a very important part of this whole process. And it is illegal to sell an animal prior to them passing this withdrawal time. Now, if there's also a next step, the Food Safety Inspection Service at the packing plants where animals are processed inspect animals and any suspect animals. They actually pull tissue samples to see if there's any residues left in those animals. So if there happens to be a condition that makes the veterinarian that's inspecting them think, well, that probably had been treated, they will actually pull samples to make sure there's no antibiotic violated residues in the animal. So that's just a safety aspect to follow up to what we as producers actually do. So in summary, it's proper diagnosis, making sure we're treating the right ailment with the right product. We use the appropriate compound, product selection, or combination sometimes, and follow a treatment protocol. Now, most treatment protocols are set up by the veterinarian specific to your operation and your production practices. And then the last thing is to adhere to those withdrawal times.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think we're going to probably start to broach the subject again. And I think what we've seen over the last couple of years, most notably since Miguel Diaz-Canel decided to acknowledge Maduro's election victory, which most of the world did not, he aligned with some of the folks that probably did not mesh well with a relationship with the United States.
Representative Rick Crawford from Arkansas is a member of the House Ag Committee.
That sort of took a lot of the luster off of this effort to try to normalize relationships with Cuba. And so it sort of stalled, quite frankly. And I think people probably looked at it as if they, myself included, I don't want to go down that road and alienate, my colleagues over this issue when Miguel Diaz-Canel, I had hoped that when he ascended to the position that he's in now, that he would be a reformer-type figure. That was the impression I got initially. I haven't had the opportunity to meet him, but there was an effort on their part to facilitate a meeting, and after the Maduro thing, I was kind of cooled on him a little bit. We're starting to see that turn. I think people need to understand that the Cuba trade is a highly charged political issue that presidents don't want to touch typically in their first term. And the reason is because Florida is a pivotal state, and the Cuban Americans in South Florida are very vocal. But I honestly think that, and I've seen polling over the years, and when I say over the years, I'm talking about probably the last, 5 or 6 years, that we're seeing a generational shift in the attitude toward our relationship with Cuba. And so now we have, millennial Cuban Americans asking the question, why can't I not go back and visit my grandmother or my grandfather in Cuba? Valid point. And we saw that President Obama took some steps to that end, but everything he did was executive action. And I think the mistake that he made was he assumed he needed, obviously, we had a Republican majority throughout most of his tenure, and he assumed that Republicans wouldn't support anything to do with changing the posture in Cuba. I think that was not a good assumption. So he did everything unilaterally through executive action. And, of course, then Trump came in and sort of reflexively did away with all of that. So we've not been able to make progress in a meaningful way in that, because it's a back and forth. It's always a political football. And I think, quite frankly, on the ag front, we would be doing ourselves and the Cuban people a major favor by saying, let's start this process by selling U.S. ag products in Cuba. And if we can get there, I think we can take the next steps and build on that. There are those in Congress that propose a full-on repeal of the embargo and an immediate sort of reestablishment of a relationship with Cuba. I'm not rejecting that, but I think the best place to start is with ag.
But when it comes to opportunities, Doug LaMalfa, a representative from California and a member of the House Ag Committee, says,
in rural California, we're interested in having these same opportunities as are in these densely packed urban areas. More light industry could be moving to my district instead of being all crammed together down in the Bay Area and the Silicon Valley where they need to, build more chips. I mean, we have a chip shortage, not potato chip. The chips that you would use for the different types of electronics. We can't get pickups. I stopped at one of my auto dealers the other day. They can't get vehicles because there's a shortage of chips, for crying out loud. Why aren't we making those in America? Why aren't we making those from a reliable supply?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think many of our states, we're in their second year of drought, some maybe even a little bit of a third.
Chandler Gould is CEO, National Association of Wheat Growers, on some of the weather challenges for growers this year.
We are going to see lower winter wheat production coming off of this year, and as well as some difficulties most likely with our spring wheat, even though that their issues were usually a little too wet getting into the field. The main point is going to be that we're going to have one of the lowest winter wheat productions this year due to that severe drought that was just widespread. I mean, all the way from the Pacific Northwest across the Great Plains. Really, once you got past the east side of the Mississippi, things got better. But, as we had our state's report, some of them would come in and say, well, it wasn't as bad as we thought, but it's still not good. And so we'll get a more accurate picture of that at the end of September when the small grains report comes out from the USDA. But I do know that I've already got growers concerned about the continued lack of moisture, because it's time to start planting winter wheat again, depending on where you live, sometime this month or next month. So this drought is now affecting basically three production seasons, depending on where you're at.
And while we can't quite predict when the weather will change and moisture will return,
in 23 days, not legislative days, 23 real days, the Farm Bill does expire. And I know that Chairman Thompson and the House Ag Committee has been working diligently to try to get a bill out of his committee before the expiration. But I feel that with the backlog on the House floor and the fact that we weren't even able to get the Ag Appropriations Bill to the floor before the August break is going to delay and postpone progress on the farm bill, not only because of the issues that you have in the Rules Committee with the Freedom Caucus, but then also because we've got a funding issue. Not only on September 30th does the farm bill expire, but if the House and Senate can't come to an agreement on spending bills, then the government shuts down on October 1st. And that will permanently delay progress on the farm bill until we can get the government opened back up. And so there's just a lot of things flying around here in D.C. that's got leverage on any type of progress on our farm bill or really any legislation moving through the process.
So what are high priorities in the farm bill for wheat growers? Gould explains.
Well, we, of course, want to continue to maintain, if not expand, crop insurance, make maybe some of the higher coverage products more affordable, making sure the safety net is truly a safety net. I mean, it clearly has not kept up with the cost of production, especially with the trade wars we had and then COVID and then supply chains and then add inflation on top of it. The safety net is just really not a true safety net anymore. And so trying to figure out ways to increase that, not only for the U.S. wheat producers, but for all farmers. But the problem with that, Tony, is when you start tinkering with ARC and PLC, you start talking in billions of dollars and pennies increases. And so trying to figure a way to strengthen that safety net, keep us in crop insurance program. We want to double MAP and FMD funding for our export markets, and then, of course, make sure that we maintain voluntary conservation programs that do not put any additional restrictions on production for eligibility. So there's a lot moving around out there, but unfortunately, there's not a lot of money in the farm bill this year. And so if we see any changes, they're going to be more programmatic or regulatory. I don't see a lot of new programs or a lot of big changes coming into this farm bill, especially if it's going to cost any money.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The 2024 budgets have some changes in it relative to 23 and 2022, and the bigger ones are twofold.
Dr. Gary Schnittke is a University of Illinois ag economist.
First, prices for corn and soybeans have declined, and we're reflecting that in the 2024 budgets. In 2022, corn prices that farmers received averaged $6.40 in the state. For 2024, we are going to be down at $4.80, which is where fall bids for 2024 on future contracts are at. Similarly, soybean prices declined from $14 to $12.80. That decline, along with trend yields, result in much lower revenue going forward into 2024, and we are including no other revenue from ARC PLC, ad hoc federal payments, or crop insurance at this point. The other change is a decline in fertilizer prices that then gets translated into lower fertilizer costs. On corn, fertilizer costs declined from $2.40 in 2022, going up to $2.50 in 2023, but back down to $1.80 in 2024. That's a substantial decline in fertilizer cost, and as a result, total non-line costs will be lower in 2024 compared to 2023. Still, we're looking at high non-line costs from a historical perspective and high break-even prices to cover total cost. Those are above $5 for corn and above $12 for soybeans, those break-even prices. So we're looking at a different price regime. Overall, we are projecting much lower returns for both corn and soybeans moving into 2023 and 2024. 2020, 2021, and 2022 were high returning years because of high prices. Those prices have turned down, and while those prices aren't as low as they were in 2014 through 2019, we have much lower returns because of the higher non-land costs and higher cash rents. While coming down, they're not coming down to the same extent that revenue is. We are back in return range comparable to 2014 to 2019 in 2023 and 2024. We're back to normal.
So how will ag exports factor into this? Rod Bain reports.
USDA's revised ag trade numbers show imports of over $196 billion with a B dollars, down from the quarterly forecast in May of $198 billion in imports for fiscal year 2023. Yet USDA's first look at FY24 ag trade shows imports reaching a record of $199.5 billion. Sean Arena of the Office of the Chief Economist explains, however, that most of our imported agricultural product
are in non-competitive type of areas. Import of products like bananas, pineapples, mangoes, coffee, tropical zone products that we don't produce really here in the U.S. And we also have a lot of counter-seasonal type of products we import that sort of complement our own growing cycles. Think of things like blueberries. There's a lot of processed foods mixed in here too, including alcoholic beverages, which do encompass a big part of our imports. Think of things like tequila.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Most American consumers would assume that the farmers are doing pretty well with that, but the bottom line is they're not.
Austin Scott is a representative from Georgia, a member of the House Ag Committee.
Cotton prices are up. There's some things that are good. It's not all doom and gloom on the farm, but the farmer is not getting the increased cost that the consumer is paying at the grocery store. It's being eaten up in the supply chain after it leaves the farm.
But it seems like every conversation continues to come back to China.
You don't want one country to have too much control over your financial future, and unfortunately, the more debt that you have out there, the more susceptible you are to that. Most of the time when people talk about that, they talk about the amount of U.S. debt that China controls and has purchased. The fact of the matter is China has a debt problem right now, and so do most of the countries in the world. And so globally, I think there's a tremendous amount of risk in all of the economies throughout the world right now. And, you know, we're going to have to come together and become a more productive, not just America being a more productive country, but countries who share our values and our interests. We have to collectively become more productive.
But it's not just free trade, it's fair trade.
And look, given our choices, we prefer to have China as a trade partner, but the one thing you don't want is any of your trade partners to be in a dominant position over you. And so in your economy, you either grow something or you build something. A lot of people say, well, China's kicking our rear end. China's not kicking our rear end. We're kicking our own rear end with stupid rules and regulations that have forced manufacturers to move to China. And so we need to do a better job of getting that manufacturing back into the U.S., and if not into the U.S., at least into countries that share our interests and our values. One of the things that we have not, I think, talked enough about is what China has done in controlling the inputs in agriculture. And so as you see, you know, consolidation in the inputs that our farmers have access to, I'm very concerned about China's influence in the theft of technology, the influence that they have in the seed and the chemical business. I mean, the things that we use to grow the crops at the volume and the quality that we do inside the United States, I do not want that to be contingent on a supply chain that originates in China. And so one of the things that we've got to do as we do the research and the development of these new technologies in our university systems, we need to make sure that manufacturing production of seed and chemicals stays inside the United States. And we need to make sure that it's not owned by the Chinese Communist government, whether they do it through the purchase of other companies or however they do it. We need to make sure that we control our destiny with our inputs in agriculture.
Again, Austin Scott from Georgia on the other side of the country. Doug LaMalfa from California is a farmer.
And we're way too dependent on China for too many things, including some of our export market. Now, our almond folks, they were over the barrel here not too long ago because of dealing with China. But I think President Trump was trying really hard to restore a trade balance, and we were moving that direction on trade in ag. And, you know, we need continuity to keep doing things right like that.
Scott and LaMalfa, both members of the House Ag Committee. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Crop and livestock producers received less in prices for their commodities for the month of July, according to USDA's latest agricultural prices report. The total prices received index recorded a 2.1% decrease in what producers received price-wise compared to the previous month. This reflects both month-over-month reductions in the crop and livestock production price index. Crop growers received 1.2% less for their commodities price-wise in July, with lower prices for food and feed grains such as wheat and corn offsetting higher prices received by growers of soybeans, fruit, and tree nuts. The price index for livestock producers was lower 2% from the previous month. A 13% reduction in prices received for poultry and eggs was behind the decrease. Meat animal producers, however, noted an almost 3% increase in what they received as prices for their commodities in July. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.